You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Opinion surveys consistently suggest that the British public is overwhelmingly hostile to migration, a hostility which shapes public policy in many ways, often negatively. However, if we dig a little deeper into the polling data, it becomes clear that most people in Britain are not pro or anti-immigration per se. Despite overall hostility to migration, there are many types of migration that are widely accepted and even popular with the general public. I'm Madeline Grant, editorial manager at the IEA, and today I'm joined by our head of political economy, Dr. Christian Niemitz, the author of our latest report, Into Migration. Christian proposes a new approach to migration after Brexit that would capitalise on these nuances in public opinion in order to push for the most liberal migration policy. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our podcast channel, IEA Conversations.
So Christian, at a time when everyone is kind of focusing on the general implosion of Parliament, it was really refreshing to read your new report on migration, which is actually looking forward to what happens after Brexit to propose a liberal migration policy. Can you briefly summarise some of the main suggestions in your report?
Yes. First of all, I'm proposing a two-lane system where you have pretty much like now a fast lane, which is free movement, and a standard lane, which is the tier system, the tier visa system. But there are a couple of key differences. First of all, free movement would apply to a different set of countries than it does now. It would be maintained for Western Europe, first of all. That's because free movement within the EU was never controversial until the eastward expansion of the EU. Before 2004, hardly anyone talked about free movement, was barely a subject at all. Even UKIP barely mentioned it at the time. It only became controversial when various Eastern European countries joined. So I'm saying if free movement cannot be saved completely, which would be my first preference, I think free movement has been a huge success. Ideally, I would keep it, but if that can't be done politically, then let's keep it at least for some countries.
So your report is called Immigration, Picking the Low-Hanging Fruit. And as you alluded to earlier, you know, free marketeers like us can wax lyrical about open borders until the cows come home. But the general public is never going to support a complete open borders policy. But what I think your report does that is so clever is that it looks for where are these kind of cleavages in public opinion that you can, the nuances that you can, I guess, exploit in a way to try and push for the most liberal migration policy. So you've mentioned the Eastern Europe v Western Europe thing. What are some of the other groups of migrants that people feel very positively about?
It's generally people from culturally similar countries. That's why when... I mean, there is a ritual that I've witnessed a couple of times over the years. I went to debates about immigration, and then during the Q&A session, there is always a scene where somebody stands up and says, somebody with what is easily recognizably an American or an Australian or New Zealand accent, and says, speaking as an immigrant myself, and then everybody in the room laughs. Now, why do they laugh? What's so funny about that? It is the fact that we all know at some level that when people talk about immigration, it's not Australians that they have in mind. It's not Canadians that they have in mind. But we also know that we're not supposed to say that. It's impolite.
You're meant to just call them expats.
Yeah, that's usually the distinction. If you're Western European or Australian, then you're an expat. If you're from a place that is more distant in cultural terms, then you're an immigrant. That is the implicit distinction that nearly everyone makes, but that is considered impolite to talk about it. But I'm saying if it is so clear that almost nobody has a problem with people from culturally similar countries coming, why not get rid of the obstacles there? Why not just extend free movement to all of them? And instead of pretending that in the eyes of the public, every immigrant is alike.
Yeah. I think another reason why people feel often hostile to migration is they worry that, often wrongly, that migrants are taking out more from the system than they are putting back in. And I suppose what you're proposing would get around that, because you would also be taking in wealthier groups of migrants, and there would be no question that they would be, you know, I don't really like to use this term, but, you know, like a drain on the resources.
Yes, that is an issue which is hugely overstated. It's perfectly clear from all the studies that have been done on this that even migrants from poorer countries, from Eastern Europe in particular, are in aggregate terms net contributors. They pay in more than they take out, even if you take account of in-work benefits and use of the NHS and other public services. Even if you take account of all that, it still remains the case that they are net contributors. So it's usually overestimated that problem of people being a drain on public resources. But nonetheless, it is a concern, and it's generally true that the reason why the idea of a points-based system, a selective system, was so popular was that it comes with this promise that we can just pick the people who are the best fit, the best match. And what I'm showing in the paper is that immigration between rich countries is already pretty much like that, even where it is completely uncontrolled. The outcomes are pretty much the same as what a highly selective points-based system would also produce. If you look at the skills profile of Western Europeans coming here, you'll find that there are almost no unskilled people among them, and a very large proportion, something like 2/3, have university education or some technical equivalent of that. So they are disproportionately very highly qualified. Pretty much what advocates of a points-based system would want, except that it happens automatically through self-selection. There are no legal obstacles. You could have thousands of construction workers, for example, from Belgium or from Switzerland, moving here. It's just that in practice, that does not happen. You get bankers and doctors moving here, but not people with lower skills. It generally doesn't happen.
And so why would we just want more bureaucracy for the sake of it?
Exactly.
The another argument I think very strongly, I did a little bit of work on this recently, very strongly anti the idea of a points-based system, is the fact that in the early noughties, when, as you mentioned earlier, the EU expanded to take in Eastern European countries, government ministers just massively got it wrong on how many people they predicted to come into the country by kind of hundreds of thousands of people more than they estimated. That really doesn't bode well for the idea of these things being determined in a centralised fashion, because if they can't even predict how many people are coming into the country in a given year, why would we expect government officials to be able to plan the entire, from a kind of top-down position, the entire skill needs of our country? It just makes no sense.
Yes, it sounds superficially seductive, this idea that you just select the right kind of immigrants, select the immigrants that the country needs. Well, who determines what the country needs? How would we even know that? We don't really need anything other than bread and water and some very basic shelter. Most goods and services that are produced in a prosperous economy are nice to have, but not strictly speaking necessary. And that's true of, or by extension, of the input factors such as skilled labor, labor more generally going into it. We don't strictly speaking need anything. Even if you closed down the borders completely and expelled all sorts of talented people, the economy would not collapse, the country would not disappear. We would be substantially poorer, but somehow life would go on. This concept of need is very much a highly arbitrary and necessarily highly politicized notion. That's why, to the extent that the immigration system already works like that, it is highly politicized. We have a so-called shortage occupation list. Those are the professions that are exempt from some of the requirements of the tier 2 visa system. And what you get there is essentially just lobbying. You get various groups, employer groups, saying the skills that we need have to be exempt. They must be on this shortage occupation list. But basically, this can maybe more or less work for skills where demand is more or less fixed, for professions where demand is more or less fixed, such as, say, nursing, because demand for nurses is highly inelastic. There clearly is a certain number of nurses that you need to run a hospital. If we had no nurses at all, you couldn't just say, right, let's just not have healthcare anymore. You need a certain level of healthcare. But at the same time, you can't expand it very much, because even if we somehow doubled the number of nurses, people wouldn't say, right, I'm going to the hospital more often now because there are more often. So this is clearly a case where demand is relatively fixed. But most other sectors of the economy are not like that. If we had fewer chefs, for example, fewer cooks, then it's not necessarily the case that we would get any indicators of a shortage. It's not that that restaurant owners would hand-wringingly search for cooks and give an arm and a leg to find one. It's just we would just have fewer restaurants. Yeah. In the same way, imagine we had only 100 people in the country who had the skills necessary to work in finance. Would this mean that those 100 people would be extremely sought after? No. It would mean that Britain would just not have a financial industry.
Yeah.
And therefore, we wouldn't miss it.
They would actually all go to Frankfurt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But a points-based system, if we imagine a parallel universe where Britain never had any Indian migration, no points-based system or no other type of visa system would now detect a skills shortage of people who know how to make Indian curry. Yeah. We would just not know what that is.
Yeah, that's right. It's a kind of counterfactual position, isn't it? The other thing about the skill needs, I guess I use that word as a kind of shorthand. I think what I mean by it is more the fact that a business is looking to recruit someone, and particularly if they've gone through the tier two route, it's incredibly onerous and difficult, and you have to jump through so many hoops that it should almost be taken for granted, I think, that if a business wants to hire someone on a T2 visa, they haven't done that for banter reasons. They've done it because they have a need for that job. And given how onerous it is, I think, you know, it's something like you have to be on 30 grand a year, is that right? They have to prove that they couldn't find anyone in the country to do that job. You know,
we
already have an incredibly burdensome system. And so I guess when we're talking about skill needs, we should take for granted that businesses are not hiring tier two people from abroad just because they fancy it.
Yes. Yeah. I'm also suggesting to simplify the tier system in the paper. First of all, by getting rid of the cap of it. At the moment, the absolute amount, the absolute number of tier two visas is capped at 20,000, I think 700 a year, so ridiculously no number. That could happen. That is already mentioned in the white paper. So if they go along with it, that is not unlikely to happen, that they get rid of the cap. That would be a big improvement. Mm. But that can only really be a first step. There is also, as you said, a lot of needless bureaucracy in there. There is the salary threshold, or rather there are two salary thresholds. There's first of all an absolute one, which is 30,000. And on top of that, there's also a sector-specific one, meaning that if you want to work in a high-paid profession, then you also have to clear the second threshold, which would be substantially higher than that. And I'm proposing that we should just get rid of this second threshold at all. If somebody can land a job at 30,000 a year, that is considerably above the national average. Clearly, that person is going to be a net contributor, and there's no need to put any additional hurdles in place.
Yeah.
And also things like English language tests. Well, yeah, I can see why an individual employer would want to see some proof of language fluency. But why is that the Home Office's job? I want to see someone who can get a job at a salary above the national average without speaking the language of the country.
Yeah.
Pretty much impossible.
Why not? What if you're doing a job, for example, you're a software developer, so you need to speak in JavaScript, not English? It seems ludicrous that we would actually prevent someone who could be earning, let's say, upwards of £50,000 a year because their English isn't perfect.
Yeah, in that case, yeah, maybe that person wouldn't need it, but then, yeah, what would be the problem with that? That would be a problem for that person, of course. They would have to navigate their everyday life and... But that would be up to them then.
And that, I think, speaks to another key issue with skills-based migration systems, because it kind of assumes that immigrants have to be sort of the finished product by when they arrive at the country. But in practice, people as happens with native British people, when they enter the workforce or they leave university, they develop skills as they go along. And it's not often not clear what skills people will develop throughout their lives or what direction they might go in. And I guess by cutting it off at that in that quite absolutist way that you have to be at X place by the time before we will let you in, it prevents that process from taking place.
Yes, that's particularly true in the kind of economy that Britain has nowadays. Maybe it would have just about worked in the 1950s, where you had a lot more people working in heavy industries and manufacturing, where it is more or less true that you leave school, do an apprenticeship, and acquire some basic skills, and then on the job you deepen them. But nowadays, with creative industries in particular, design, media, tech, it's not really like that. There is not a fixed set off-the-shelf career path, yeah, where you learn a fixed number of skills at university and then go on to apply them. It's more that you start working maybe as an unpaid intern initially, or somewhere on a low salary, doing non-glamorous work initially for a while, and then acquire skills on the job and eventually find your way. And yes, you're right. If we get a system that insists that you have to earn more than the national average already, otherwise you can't come in, then you cut off that route. That's why I'm trying to move as many people as possible into the free movement zone. I'm describing this this two-lane system. In one lane, you would have a minimum salary threshold. In the free movement lane, you would not. And ideally, you would have as many countries as possible, whenever that is politically possible, in the free movement lane, so that career path, working on a low salary initially, but then acquiring the experience, acquiring the job-related skills on the job, and working your way up, so that absolutely stays open.
So with the free movement lane, do you go about it purely on a kind of country-by-country basis, or are there other factors involved as well?
In that particular case, I've merely gone for what is publicly acceptable. There are a number of surveys that ask from which countries would you accept more migration, or at least the current volumes of migration, and from which countries would you rather have less migration going on? And where are you more or less okay with current numbers? And it turns out there are massive differences. And yeah, they are pretty much as you would expect, that developed English-speaking countries are at the top, followed closely by Western European countries. There you have absolute majorities, usually more than 50%, saying more or at least the current numbers, absolutely fine with that. And hardly anyone saying, oh no, we need to clamp down on those people coming in. And then you get a lot of countries that where there isn't a clear pattern, where you have some people approving, some people objecting, and at the bottom of that hierarchy, you get lots of countries, particularly Middle Eastern and African, where the overwhelming majority says, no, I'd rather have fewer people from those places arriving. So I'm saying what to do about those countries in the middle of that chart, I don't know, but let's avoid the difficult issues for now. Let's look at the obvious parts of that problem, and there it's pretty obvious for at least developed English-speaking countries and Western Europe, developed countries more broadly, that there is very widespread public acceptance. So I'm saying, if that is so clear-cut, if there's such strong approval here, then why not take these people out of any bureaucratic requirements and just give them free movement rights automatically?
Yeah, I think it's a very wise undertaking, because sometimes free marketeers, you know, we have to be careful that we propose things that are politically possible and not just as we would like them to be. Even if we do make the case at the same time for free movement, right now the public is not there yet. And it's up to us to win people round, but in the meantime, look for the most liberal migration policy that's compatible with public opinion. Your report also proposes to scrap any kind of net migration target. Do you think that would actually be compatible with public opinion?
I think it would. It doesn't seem that way at the moment, because The way the immigration debate works at the moment is that almost everybody who advocates cutting migration, who argues that immigration is a problem, would phrase that in terms of physical constraints, logistical constraints. The main argument being the country is simply full. It's not physically possible to accommodate more people. Now, that is simply not true, and I don't think anyone genuinely believes that. It's more that phrasing objections in those terms is a way to sanitize the subject. It makes it less controversial. If you express reservations about, if you talk about integration and community cohesion, you might get accused of being xenophobic or racist or a bigot. And whereas if you just talk about overcrowding, you avoid that problem. If you are on an overcrowded train, then clearly you don't feel any personal animosity towards anyone else who is on that train. You're not blaming your fellow passengers individually, but you would still rather have fewer of them. If half of them got off the train, you would be happy about that. That's not because there's anything wrong with them. It's just that there is this physical constraint on that. But the thing is, that isn't true. And I think everyone who makes that argument should, in their own minds, ask themselves the following question. They should do the following thought experiment. Imagine the 5 million or so British nationals who live abroad permanently, the 5 million expats, decided to move back to Britain all at once. So you had a net increase of 5 million people in the population. Would you feel compelled to make the same overcrowding physical constraints argument? I'm pretty sure almost nobody would.
Mm.
Because there you divorce it from the tricky subject of integration, and you make it really purely about physical constraints. I don't think anyone would then say, oh no, we can't accept those homecomers. They have to stay where they are. They have to stay at the Spanish coast because we can't accommodate them. There, I think it's pretty clear most people would say, yeah, of course they should come back. And if there aren't enough houses, then we should build more houses. If there aren't enough doctors, then we should hire more doctors. If there aren't enough roads, then we should build more roads. The physical infrastructure argument really is just a way to avoid the tricky subjects. Basically what it means, having an influx of people, if you ignore the subject of integration for a moment, what it means is simply that Britain would be a bigger country, population-wise, in the same way in which Britain is already a bigger country than say, Ireland, and in which Ireland is a bigger country than Iceland, and in which Iceland is a bigger country than Liechtenstein. It doesn't mean that it's therefore harder to provide housing or infrastructure. Because, yes, of course, you have more people who need those services and amenities, but you also have more people who are able to provide them. You have more patients, but you also have more taxpayers and more potential doctors and more potential nurses. So it really doesn't matter how many people there are.
Yeah, that's a really important point. I wonder also whether the way we actually organise our economy and how centralised it is, that could be contributing to the problem too, because it may be that influxes of new people into a particular area, well, those pressures will be felt very intensely at a local level, but nevertheless, things like the NHS and local services, an awful lot of them, are still completely governed from a national level. So perhaps it's not the best system to quickly respond to areas of high demand, because, you know, as we know, there are parts of the country where there's very little migration to speak of. It seems to be, you know, very specific areas that feel these pressures.
Yes, that's where our side of the argument sometimes gets it wrong. We look at aggregate statistics where we can clearly see that the migrant population are, in aggregate terms, net contributors. They pay more than they take out. So, and then we clearly move from saying, okay, if there are capacity constraints, then clearly that cannot be because of migration. Well, it can still be true if that net contribution that those people make gets spent on completely different things. If you have people paying in, let's say, 10 million or 10 billion pounds and consuming only, let's say, 7 billion in public services, then yes, in aggregate terms, they are net contributors. But if their tax money gets spent on, let's say, high-speed rail too, which has nothing to do with demand for schools or the NHS and so on, then it could still be true that you have increased demand for those services without more money being spent on it. Then it could still be true that migration is a drain. Even though those people make the contribution, they could pay their way. It's just that the system would prevent them from paying their way, because the contribution they make doesn't necessarily go towards the services and the infrastructure that they're using. That's why I'm proposing, first of all, that we should have a much more localized tax system. That's something which I think would make a lot of sense anyway. It's generally the case that more decentralized systems, like in Switzerland or in Canada or even the Nordic countries, have higher levels of accountability. You get a better match between local preferences and the provision of local services. You get a political discovery process, and it would simply mean that if one area experiences a large influx of migrants and another area doesn't, then that first area, the one with the influx, would also automatically see a big increase in tax revenue, because the taxes paid by those migrants would largely stay in the area in which they live. And then locally, policymakers in that area could say, right, we have this influx, we therefore have increased pressure on our local infrastructure, so we're going to use our tax revenue to provide more infrastructure. Whereas the second area that wouldn't have an increase in immigration wouldn't have that problem, and they would not have the tax revenue either. That's why this is much less of an issue in Switzerland, even though they have more immigration proportionately to population size than Britain has. But they have a system, firstly, of localized taxes, and also they have an insurance-based healthcare system. So this idea that migrants would be a drain on the healthcare sector would not arise, because immigrants would just have to have health insurance like everyone else.
Your report proposes creating a free movement area between Canada, Australia, New Zealand and the UK. That would be extraordinarily popular, wouldn't it?
Yes, there are various campaign groups that advocate that at the moment, and they draw... they point to surveys that show that there is something like a two-thirds majority in favor of that. So those are exactly the kinds of examples that I was looking for. Low-hanging fruits, areas where liberalization is an easy win, where you can do something that's right from a liberal perspective, liberalizes immigration, but that's also popular. I was specifically looking for those low-hanging fruits, and that has to be maybe the most clear-cut example of it. Widespread popular support, and it also makes a lot of economic sense. Why not take those people out of all the bureaucratic requirements? Why not make their lives easier without making it harder for everyone else? I would ideally not leave it there, but expand free movement to other countries as well. But as long as that cannot be done, why not do it where it is already possible and where it could be done overnight?
Christian, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
For more podcasts, blogs, reports and films, go to our website at iea.org.uk.